Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the February 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. 2 weeks ago, on January 25th, Egyptians in the world marked the anniversary of the start of the mass protest in Cairo's Tahrir Square that eventually led to the end of Hosni Mubarak's 3 decades of dictatorial rule. It was one of the breathtaking moments of what came to be called the Arab Spring. Now, a year later, the country and the Arab world appear to be experiencing what might be called the Arab Winter. Despite the country's first free and fair elections, the military is still in control in Egypt, and people are back protesting in Tahrir Square. In Libya, following the U.S. and NATO-backed overthrow of the Gaddafi regime, the country is in chaos. While Syrians and their government are engaged in a bloody battle that defies any simple description or analysis. Last October, when I spoke with journalist Hannah Albayati on the ground in Cairo, she presented an optimistic view of Egypt's future, and today I'm going to be looking for her assessment of the current situation when I call her there about 20 minutes past the hour. In the U.S., the biggest story of the moment regarding Egypt has been the shutting down of foreign NGOs, including 3 from the U.S. with likely links to the CIA, and the announcement by the Egyptian government that at least 19 Americans, including Sam LaHood, the son of Transportation Secretary and former Congressman Ray LaHood, will be put on trial and charged with managing unlicensed non-governmental organizations and receiving foreign funds, which has led members of Congress to call for a cut of the $1.3 billion in military aid that Egypt is due under the Camp David Agreement. There's an implication in Egypt's charges that the NGOs have been attempting to destabilize the government, something in which the National Endowment for Democracy, the parent organization of 2 of the groups, is a past master. Those 2 are the National Democratic Institute, which opened an office in Egypt in 2005, and the International Republican Institute. The institutes, loosely affiliated with the Republican and Democratic parties, were established by Congress in 1983 and with a national endowment became key players in Ronald Reagan's Cold War crusade. Both are financed by the National Endowment, which is set up in the same year, ostensibly to promote democracy in developing countries. The National Endowment's website states that it was, quote, premised on the idea that American assistance on behalf of democracy efforts abroad would be good both for the U.S. and for those struggling around the world for freedom and self-government, end quote. The real idea behind National Endowment, however, was to create an organization to do overtly what the CIA had long been doing clandestinely. A lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA, acknowledged Alan Weinstein, one of the National Endowment's founders in 1991. And that was 21 years ago, and like the Energizer Bunny, the National Endowment is still going strong. It's currently involved in Syria, where the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies, headed by Dr. Radwan Ziada, has served as a front for its activities. Ziada is also director of the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington and has served as a spokesperson for the Syrian National Council, an organization of Syrians living abroad who have been calling for Western military intervention in Syria, a move that has thus far been opposed by the opponents of the al-Assad regime within the country. This has endeared him to both the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the Foreign Policy Initiative, 2 pro-Israel neocon think tanks that are the successors to the Project for a New American Century. A less well-known connection of Ziada's is to the Fikra Forum, Fikra meaning idea in Arabic, which describes itself as a, quote, an online community that aims to generate ideas to support Arab Democrats in their struggle with authoritarians and extremists and to provide a platform for those in the region seeking to shape the future of their countries and U.S.-based decision-makers and opinion leaders who are trying to understand and support those efforts, end quote. What the site doesn't say is that the Fikra Forum is a project of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, arguably the most influential Capitol Hill think tank on Middle East issues. It was founded by Israel's U.S. lobby, AIPAC, in 1985, and has served as a vehicle for pushing Israel's agenda ever since, a fact the mainstream media never mentions. The presence of 18 fellows or associates of the Washington Institute, including several of its leading officials, on Fikra's list of contributors alerted me to its likely connection with what pretends to be an independent forum. Well, to understand what's taking place in Syria today, it is necessary to consider not only the repressive history of the Syrian regime under Hafez al-Assad, and now under his son Bashir, but also the outside forces represented by the likes of Radwan Ziada that have co-opted what began initially as a peaceful, nonviolent protest for a democratic reordering of Syrian society in the spirit of the Arab Spring. Primed for the peaceful protest, those outside elements soon began to use them as a cover for armed attacks on government forces with the obvious intention of provoking the Assad regime to respond with heavy military force as it has, thereby leading to external demands for foreign intervention and the demand for Assad's ouster. Who's behind it? Well, the U.S., the British, the French, the Turks, and the Saudis, of course, and Qatar and Israel. On April 15, 2003, less than a month into the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Financial Times noted that Israeli Chief of Staff Shaul Mofaz had told the Israeli daily Maariv that, quote, "We have a long list of issues that we are thinking of demanding of the Syrians, and it is proper that it should be done through the Americans. It starts from removing the Hezbollah threat from southern Lebanon and for an end to Iranian aid to Hezbollah through Syrian ports," end quote. On the same day, beneath the headline, "Israel to U.S., now deal with Syria and Iran," Haaretz Aluf Ben wrote, quote, "Two of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's senior aides will go to Washington for separate talks this week and suggest that the United States also take care of Iran and Syria because of their support for terror and pursuit of weapons of mass destruction." They must have been buoyed when, in the week following the invasion, Secretary of State Powell announced to delegates at AIPAC's annual conference that Syria and Iran are, quote, supporting terror groups and will have to face the consequences, end quote. Today that seems like an understatement. Frankly, it's impossible to tell what's happening in Syria from what we hear on BBC, NPR, or Qatar-owned Al Jazeera, all of which are openly supporting regime change and minimizing the aggressive actions of the Free Syrian Army and other groups operating independently, which are being funded and armed from the outside. Last week, I received an article that included an 8-minute video of the aftermath of a rally in Damascus last month, in which Bashir al-Assad had spoken to a crowd of thousands, many of whom, mostly young, were lingering about the square afterward, talking, joking, dancing traditional dabka, and having a good time. Clearly, they had not been forced to be there, and apart from the dancing and the presence of Syrian flags, it could have been the aftermath of any large political rally here. The journalist who made the video, Sharmeen Narwani, described her meeting with regime opponents, most of whom, she writes, quote, had served prison terms at some point in their lives. They varied, she says, from those who desired an overhaul of the regime while keeping Assad's presidency intact to those who would not consider dialogue with any part of the existing government. There were some commonalities, though, she found. All rejected any foreign military intervention and the militarization of the protests. The majority were scathing about the Free Syrian Army and the external opposition groups like the Syrian National Council, so liberally quoted by the Western media as a definitive voice of the Syrian opposition. When it had first been announced, there was some attention directed to a delegation of the Arab League that went to Syria to carry out a fact-finding mission. But lo and behold, when it completed its 30-page report and presented it to the UN Security Council, not a single mainstream news source mentioned it or its findings, and the UN Security Council also chose to ignore it. And that should be no surprise when one reads it. Although it confirmed and criticized armed actions by the Syrian government against the public, it also noted that, quote, in Homs, that's the town which is now under siege by the government, in Homs and Deraa, the mission observed armed groups committing acts of violence against government forces, resulting in death and injury among their ranks. In certain situations, government forces responded to attacks against their personnel with force. The observers noted that some of the armed groups were using flares and armor-piercing projectiles. In Homs, Idlib, and Hama, the observer mission witnessed acts of violence being committed against government forces and civilians that resulted in several deaths and injuries. Examples of those acts include the bombing of a civilian bus, killing 8 persons and injuring others, including women and children, and the bombing of a train carrying diesel oil. In another incident in Homs, a police bus was blown up, killing 2 police officers. A fuel pipeline and some small bridges were also bombed. The mission noted that many parties falsely reported that explosives or violence had occurred in several locations. When the observers went to those locations, they found that those reports were unfounded. The mission, I'm quoting from the report, the mission also noted that according to its teams in the field, the media exaggerated the nature of the incidents and the number of persons killed in incidents and protests in certain towns. And quote, in any case, if in case one thinks the mission was in the pocket of the Syrian government, another section of the report noted that, quote, although it welcomed the mission and its head and repeatedly emphasized that it would not impose any security restrictions that could obstruct the movement of the mission, the government deliberately attempted to limit the observers' ability to travel extensively in various regions. The government also attempted to focus the attention of the mission on issues in which it is interested. The mission resisted those attempts and responded to them in a manner that allowed it to fulfill its mandate and overcome the obstacles that stood in the way of its work, end quote. That's in the report of the Arab League mission to Syria, which was presented to the UN Security Council and has been completely ignored by the U.S. media. Israel appears ever closer to be launching an attack on Iran. Leon Panetta told Washington Post writer David Ignatius that Israel is likely to strike Iran between April and June before it reaches a, quote, a zone of immunity in development of a nuclear bomb. And yesterday, Sever Plaka, deputy editor of Israel's Yediot Ahronot, wrote an op-ed article which he titled, quote, War with Iran is Coming, in which he predicted that, quote, Israel will bomb Iran's nuke sites earlier than predicted with Western and Arab support, end quote. Plaka is delusional if he believes the latter, but in Israel he is far from alone. Only in this past week, the New York Times carried a front-page story which described Israeli officials, from Prime Minister Netanyahu on down, suggesting that Iran's threat to retaliate against an Israeli bombing raid on its nuclear sites are merely a bluff, and that it will accept the attack on its territory as docilely as did Saddam Hussein in 1981 when Israel destroyed Iraq's nuclear reactor at Osirik, and as did Bashar al-Assad when Israel took out what it claimed to be the beginnings of a Syrian nuclear reactor in 2007. The Times, which totally colluded with George W. Bush's march to war in Iraq, seemed intent on doing the same with regard to Iran and a likely Israeli attack. On January 29th, the paper's Sunday Magazine section presented a major article by Yedioth Ahronot, military analyst Ronen Bergman, in which he also predicted an Israeli attack on Iran. Quote, after speaking with many senior Israeli leaders and chiefs of the military and the intelligence, I have come to believe that Israel would indeed strike Iran in 2012. Perhaps in the small and ever-diminishing window that is left, the United States will choose to intervene after all. But here, from the Israeli perspective, there's not much hope for that, end quote. Making sure that he would not be perceived as letting Israel down in election season, of course, it's always election season, President Obama told an NBC interviewer at the Super Bowl that, quote, my number one priority continues to be the security of the United States, but also the security of Israel. Imagine mentioning them in the same breath. Mr. Obama went on, and we're going to make sure that we work in lockstep as we proceed to try and solve this, hopefully diplomatically, he said. Perhaps the president was responding to the extraordinary statement of last night's three-state winner, Republican presidential candidate who's out for bombing Iran, Rick Santorum, who last Friday in Missouri called on Obama to apologize to the American people for revealing that Israel's planning an attack on Iran's nuclear capability this spring. Actually, it was Leon Panetta who suggested that, but in Fulton, Missouri, who knows the difference? In a campaign rally appearance at William Woods University, Santorum drew loud applause from supporters in the nearly full Cutlip Auditorium. That's right, the Cutlip Auditorium, when he declared President Obama, quote, is the most anti-Israel and anti-Western president when it comes to the Middle East of any president in the history of our country, end quote. What President Obama did is most reprehensible, Santorum said. He should apologize to the people in this room. He should apologize to the American people for the comments he made. He should be saying, we will stand with you, Israel. We will make sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon, which is, by the way, the policy of this country, and we will work with you to make sure this happens, end quote. But that's nothing. How about Sheldon Adelson, the man who already has given $10 billion to Newt Gingrich's campaign and plans to give whatever it takes to whatever his Republican candidate to defeat Obama? In a talk in Israel in July 2010, Adelson said, quote, I am not an Israeli. The uniform that I wore in the military, unfortunately, was not an Israeli uniform. It was an American uniform. Although my wife was in the IDF, and one of my daughters was in the IDF, that's the Israeli Defense Forces. Our two little boys, one of whom will be bar mitzvahed tomorrow, hopefully he'll come back. His hobby is shooting, and he'll come back and be a sniper for the IDF, end quote. All we care about is being good Zionists, being good citizens of Israel, because even though I am not Israeli-born, Israel is in my heart. Sheldon Adelson said that. That's a man who wants to buy the presidency of the United States on behalf of a foreign country. And where's the outrage? Well, finally, at tonight's meeting of the Ukiah Planning Commission, there will be public comment taken on whatever and whether the commission should issue a statement of overriding considerations that would have the city saying, in essence, that having Walmart open 24/7, full-service grocery store at its present location, is more important to the city of Ukiah in the safety of motorists who might be killed or injured because of the traffic jams that will ensue at the 101 Talmadge Airport Boulevard interchange, for which there is no mitigation. That meeting is at the Ukiah City Hall, the 300 Seminary Drive, and will begin precisely tonight at 6 p.m.